Okay, well, I want to start by talking just a little bit more about ways of harmony, ways of abiding together among people who have different religious views, which is, seems like very important within Tibetan Buddhism, as we were talking about before, and not a resolved problem. And His Holiness has often talked about how important this is for world peace, and one of his main objectives is promoting interreligious harmony, and you can see how hard he worked at it in what we were doing yesterday. And then just transitioning from that briefly talk, just a couple of that, or maybe even integrated into that, a couple of other thoughts that came to me about how this all relates to studying tenets, and then we'll do the Chittamatra system after that, so that should all work easily in this time. I was thinking a little bit about when His Holiness took on the question of how can we understand Dzogchen practice in Nyingma as having in some fundamental way the liberative effect of realizing the lack of intrinsic nature in all things according to the Prasangika view. That, you know, and as I explained, I thought, if you read that piece very closely, that his talk, that he doesn't deviate from his view as a Prasangika, but by not being attached to certain words and terms and listening very deeply and reading very deeply in terms of how he can understand as a Prasangika what the other people are saying and how it might lead to liberation, then he finds a way of understanding what they're doing as being of great profundity, even though it's written in a completely different way. And doesn't maybe even seems on the surface to contradict some of the things that he thinks are crucial. And this reminded me a little bit, the right analogy, but it reminds me off the top of this construct in liberal Christianity called the anonymous Christian, whereas Christians coming to the conviction that it must not be the case that good people all over the world who don't believe in Jesus Christ, they could not all be going to hell, because so therefore there must, but yet on the other hand, not being able to acknowledge that there's some way that someone could be saved without Jesus Christ, they're stuck. And so then one of the ways of solving that was to say that there are anonymous Christians, which means, doesn't mean anonymous in the usual sense, but it means people who are Christians in the deeper spiritual sense, but they don't know, they don't have the name Christian, they don't apply the name Christian to themselves. They wouldn't think of themselves as Christians, but in terms of what's important to the Christian, that is the love of Christ, the love that Christ, this is like almost saying, well, when we say Christ, what we mean is this divine love. Mm-hmm. And saying, well, this person can have this exact same divine love, which we understand through Christ, but they just don't have the word Christ to go along with it, but it could add up to the same thing in terms of the transformative effect on their minds. So, I mean, this is like, but you could say in one way, a very powerful step forward in ending interreligious hatred and misunderstanding, and which I think it is. On the other hand, it has something like, if it's taken really seriously, like that, just as it said like that, it seems to have something disrespectful about it also at the same time, because these other people might not be very happy to find out that they're only okay because without their knowing it, implicitly and secretly, they're really Christians. And so I was thinking about that, like, well, how the Nyingmas will feel to find out that, well, they really are okay with the Dalai Lama, but it's only because without their actually being aware of it, they really implicitly agreed with what he was doing. Okay, but and of course that is a kind of mode of how religions deal with difference. It's called inclusivism, which is different from what we usually, you know, think, oh, well, we have the good one and you have the bad one, and so, you know, that's exclusivism. But inclusivism is saying, I have the good one and you have it too, only you just don't know it. And that's like, well, in a broad way, we think of the general way that Hinduism means. This is too broad to be true exactly, but in general, that's how we think of the mode. We think of Christianity and Islam traditionally being exclusivist, Hinduism being inclusivist. And it wasn't the same as just saying, you know, all of your different beliefs are really different and yet okay, nor saying all of your different beliefs are different and therefore we must wipe them out. It was all of your different beliefs are okay because really they add up to the same thing as my beliefs in the end. that's called inclusivism. And His Holiness told that story at Lehigh about his Christian friend, right? And he said his Christian friend introduced him to an audience of Christians and said, as here's His Holiness the Dalai Lama, a very good Christian, right? But then either it was a joke or a joke at one level and not a joke at one level, right? Because it has this whole theological background behind it, which, you know, we don't know whether His Holiness has read about that history part of Christian theology. But it has that background behind it, and so His Holiness certainly took it as a compliment, and also a you know, humorous way, and said, "Thank you very much. You know, you're a good Buddhist." Right? And so that's like perfect because he's saying, "Well, you know, I can play that game too, right? We can attribute to you all the wonderful Buddhist qualities which you don't know the names of, but nonetheless, by your actions and behavior, and I see that you have somehow attained without actually knowing you put the words in the right order, right?" And I think, you know, in the way His Holiness talks about it, this isn't a collapse. You can see the way he talks about the Nyingma difference and then also the Nyingma Gelugpa difference and also the way he talks about the Christian-Buddhist difference. He doesn't do that actual move. He doesn't actually collapse the two things. He takes it seriously that there are differences, but he tries to give as much credit as he possibly can to what's seriously worth listening to from the other side. And I think, you know, especially when he was talking about Christianity, right, he's saying, well, this is actually something different, and there's some things we have in common and some things that are really different. And that idea that instead of sort of saying, well, we will not be intolerant toward you, we will just intellectually subsume you, but instead go to an actual dialogue where you say, well, the other person has maybe something to say that that would benefit me, even though they're from another tradition. This is really threatening to people. It's very, very threatening to people. I had this conversation with some different people from different religious groups, and it's very hard for people to think that because the idea is that, like, well, everything possible worth knowing was known by the Buddha and is passed down to us, so how could there be anything that would benefit our practice by talking to a person who wasn't in that tradition? And then, of course, you can divide that down until you get to Tibetan Buddhism, Tsongkhapa's Tibetan Buddhism, you know, Venerable Chögrön, you know, it's like, don't listen to anybody else. And it's like, you get it, it's like, well, there's no way to learn from anybody who has anything to say except the one exact person, you know. And of course, you know, that doesn't seem to be the model that Tsongkhapa followed, Che Rinpoche. He won, he got Namgya Gyaltsen, who's a Nyingma, right, was helping him ascertain the view, apparently, right, according to his biography. And then his main teacher was a Sakya. And in the end, his position that he arrived at was not that of his teacher's, right? But he learned from his teacher and learned from other teachers and then arrived at something he had conviction in. So interreligious dialogue, you know, like listening means that you have to really not just sort of make a display of your tolerance, but which I, unfortunately, you know, that's kind of what it could be, but it's like, it's something where you actually have to do it, I think, in the real way, you have to have the possibility in your mind the person could say something worthwhile that you hadn't heard before within your own tradition. This is very difficult for people to acknowledge, but you see, when His Holiness is doing that with Nyingma, he does exactly that at the end of that thing piece we were going over, and he like turns it around and says, hey, from studying all this, I didn't just learn that in a way I can consider these people as okay. I also learned something about how to identify the fundamental nature of my mind that, all you know, we're not doing over here on the Gelugpa side, okay? So that idea that dialogue where you take the other party seriously is having something different and not just another version of yourself, and then being open to not that you will abandon your own commitments, but that you'll become deeper and richer in how you practice or understand them by listening to some ideas that are coming in from different streams. I think His Holiness has embodied it. And also, the first person I had heard really talk about this was a Christian named John Hick. John Hick has this modern liberal Christian theology, which from his point of view is just a modern liberal Christian tradition. He doesn't see it as being derivative from Buddhism. But, well, let me describe it to you and see what you think. It's called process theology. And process theology was developed in the early 20th century by a man named Whitehead, and there's also sort of a philosophical version of it that was associated with Hartshorne. And what these people said is like, well, all traditional Christian theology is based on these other static, unchanging entities and this absolute absolute God, and it doesn't seem to really make any sense in terms of what we as modern people are learning about how the world really works. And so their new Christian theology, called process theology, is that the entire universe is made up of entities of all different types, sizes, and they're all constantly changing and disintegrating moment by moment. And as they change, then some of them include each other, like my body is an entity, but so is my liver, and so is like a cell in my liver, so is a molecule in a cell in my liver. And so it's entities are within entities, and some have a lot of influence and some have very little influence, but they all have some influence, and none have absolute control or influence. And they all arise and pass away moment by moment, and as they interact moment by moment, arising and passing away, they give rise to new sets of entities. That's what they use, those word entities. And so God is an entity who is the entity that has the most control, you know, more than, say, the molecules, more than us, but not absolute control. So God's a power of love in the world that is the greatest possible being that any could be conceived, which turns out to not be all-powerful, but just to be more powerful than anything else. And so all these entities interact moment by moment as they're disintegrating and produce new entities, which continue to do that on and on. They don't call it dependent arising, but they almost do. They call it concrescence, which means, you know, coming into existence together. Concrescence. That's a made up word. They made up that word, and it's not, it just exists in that philosophy. Concrescence. Coming into being together. So, John Hick didn't study Buddhism. He just went to seminary and studied philosophy, and this is the philosophy he studied. He's a process theologian, process philosopher. This is how he looks at the world. He doesn't think of it as being anything Buddhist. But then he meets some Buddhists and starts talking to them and noticing, like, yeah, we should talk some more. And then he does this, like, in the mode, okay, that I'm talking about, where he's really saying, oh, you guys have something that, like, I can agree with. Let's say, what do you have that to tell me that maybe I haven't heard, in that kind of open-hearted way? And guess what he finds out? Emptiness. He said, in this whole process theology system, it was all about what Buddhists are going to call dependent arising, and we're going to call concrescence. But nobody ever turned it around and said, since all of these entities only exist impermanently, momentarily disintegrating as part of this collaborative process of ongoing co-creation, that they lack any intrinsic nature of their own and have this ungraspability. And nobody had ever said that in process theology. They just had, like, the dependent arising side, and they didn't have the emptiness side. Mm-hmm. And he's like, oh, well, we should consider this. And so I'm thinking, you know, it's like His Holiness, when he's teaching the Great Treatise, he said, well, you know, when my Christian friends ask me about emptiness, I hesitate to tell them, right? And it's like, because I'm afraid that I'll harm, you know, their confidence in in God, the Creator. And it seems clear from other things he says that he thinks that that's very important, their confidence in God, the Creator, because he sees that, that in a very powerful, intimate way. I mean, when he talks about how Christians believe in God, you can see that he's really not just thought about, but he's felt his way into it. Is that, you know, when you feel that God is your parent, there's this intimacy there, and then you really want to know what God wants you to do. And then it's not, it's like you have a sort of serious commitment to go out and try to live in love. It, you know, that's based on that kind of intimate set connection with the Creator. So he doesn't want to undermine that faith in any way by, you know, saying, well, this is completely illogical, you know, which in fact is what he thinks, right? But he doesn't want to say that to them, right? So, but then it turns out that there are some minority of Christians, like John Hick, right, who by studying process theology or something else like that, have their minds prepared to the point where emptiness is like exactly what they need to hear. And maybe, you know, and they've already adopted dependent arising as a Christian theology under a different name. But speaking from a Buddhist point of view now. Then maybe they could have a name for, we could have a special name for emptiness in Christianity too. And then we could have sort of a full blown, you know, version of Buddhist philosophy that's part of Christianity. Anyway, this just occurred to me. It's probably not going to be a popular form of Christianity. But the intellectuals like that, you know. I think there is something like that. Intellectual Christians, and at the seminaries, then they teach it. And then the people at the seminary, some of them, you know, go out. And it leaks out into the churches that way, like that.
So can Christians
be enlightened? I don't know. That's what I was thinking about yesterday. Well, okay, you know, and it's like there's so many causes and conditions for having to have enlightenment besides having a general understanding of emptiness. But I would just so like, you know, it seems like Christians can understand emptiness, right? And that's the start. Yeah. So in terms of thinking about different, this sort of goes from that over into the tenets thing. When thinking about different religions or thinking about different tenet systems within our own tradition, it reminded me of this old joke because I'm in the field of, you know, history of religions, which is usually just called comparative religion. That's my academic discipline, and I do Tibetan Buddhism within that. But there's this old joke, and say like, does having a PhD in comparative religion make you more religious? And they say, well, it makes you comparatively religious. And with the implication being, not so much. But then there's another saying that comes, of course, from within the comparative religion tradition, which is that who knows one knows none. And that sort of relates to what I was talking about, the tenet systems. Now, I don't actually think that either of these things is exactly correct. I was trying to think about what a middle way between, like, who knows one knows none. You might imply that, like, in order to know anything, we would have to continually study more and more different things in order to see that thing in the context. So it doesn't seem completely right either. But it is true, and this is what the point I was in my mind was saying, is that you do understand more about, you know, our system when you see the context of other systems that have been part of its evolution, and you see how it's different from what other people are saying and why it's important to say those different things, then it helps you understand more about ours, I think. So anyway, that's one thing, is I think that that's one thing. We understand our own tradition in a richer way when we see it in the context of other kinds of ideas. There's another Buddhist idea about studying different traditions too, which didn't occur to me to mention yesterday when you asked that question. And that is that, like, you know, Bodhisattva has to be able to teach this stuff. And people have all different kinds of minds. And if you can only explain emptiness in one way, then that kind of cuts down the number of people that you're able to, like, talk to. And that, of course, this is like a very serious point on the Bodhisattva path. It's usually not emphasized as a beginning point, but You know, one of the things that you know, why does it take a bodhisattva so long to become a Buddha? Or they can't just meditate on emptiness one way and say, oh, I got it. Because it's not just about them. It's about, well, how are you going to, like, be able to understand this in such a way to manifest it, explain it, demonstrate it, perform it in such a way to communicate to the countless different types of beings. You know, if we're working for the welfare of all beings, we have to equip ourselves in some long-range way with different predispositions for ways of teaching. Okay. So anyway, that occurred to me. Now, our teacher, as I said, the Buddha, was a shramana, or in Pali, a samana, means like a wandering renunciate, you know, Kerouac said a dharma bum, you know, he dropped out of trying to conform to what people expected in of duty in society at that time, and did so in quest of liberation and a deeper truth, a reality, you know, that would lead to that liberation. But like that was part of, there were a lot of other people who were doing that too. Just from within, in the Buddhist stories, you know that's true, because when he had meditation teachers who were, and then he had his first followers, right, were all also, you know, shramana. They were all people who had kind of dedicated themselves to renouncing ordinary appearances of society, or doing what society expected them to do, and just dedicated their lives to meditating or praying or studying or chanting or engaging in whatever mode of behavior, whether unconventional or not, that their teacher or their own, you know, development of their own wisdom seemed to be conducive to finding spiritual peace and liberation. And so these people were trying all kinds of things. Okay, they tried all kinds of things. They didn't just do one kind of thing. And I think that it's pretty clear, although, you know, that they had all different kinds of ideas that went along with these different kinds of things. They didn't just randomly say, we'll become enlightened if we go on all fours and bark like a dog, which that was one of the things. Like, they didn't just randomly say that. There was some idea behind that. But they didn't just randomly say, we'll become enlightened if we stop eating. You know, there was an idea that was behind that. So there was all these different ideas that were associated with these different practices, and everybody was talking to each other and asking questions about, yeah, that's what you say is real, but what's the real reality behind that kind of questions in the woods, which were still there, because they hadn't chopped them all down yet in India yet. Right. So if you ever look at the Upanishads, and now when people think of the Upanishads, they think of Vedanta, which has like an answer. It is like, you know, ultimately we are Atman, we're this permanent self, and that self is one with the self of the universe. And okay, that must be what the Upanishads says. But if you actually read the Upanishads, they say a whole bunch of different things. Like, this Upanishad says this, and this Upanishad says that, and the other Upanishad says the other thing. And it's like this all through. It's more kind of a record of people's inquiry into the nature of what it meant to be a human being. It's not okay, here are the official answers kind of text at all. In terms of the, then, you know, so that, I guess what I'm saying is Buddhist culture arose out of that culture. And you had different people going around saying, well, what, you know, and my argument would be, both initially didn't have books, right? They were like talking to each other and arguing and thinking and meditating and going back and forth between these, all in sort of this, those quests. What is real? You know, and the idea being that we're suffering unnecessarily because we're seeing things falsely, but what is real? What is really the ground of being? So he had this kind of inquisitive attitude. And my suggestion, at least, you know, I can't prove it, is that like all the tenet systems are not just like simply scholastic. They become scholastic products, but they have their roots in, you know, people's explorations of the question, what is real, and what by realizing will I become liberated? And these quests were not simply non-conceptual. they involved conceptuality, but it wasn't like there was a bunch of professors in an Indian school, you know, who were saying, well, what complicated set of words can we come up with next? Although that did happen, you know, then later. But it's it, all the roots of the tenet system, I think, are in this Samana inquisitory culture. In any case, of course, Tsongkhapa, whether that, as some people say, enough is enough, let's stop all this, you know, dualistic elaboration, and that kind of theme strongly comes into the literature later. But, you know, certainly Tsongkhapa thought that that pushback against dualistic elaboration had gone way too far, and that people had to come to value what could be understood by thinking and analyzing at the conventional level. That's like the thrust of his work. To a great extent. And so, yeah, I was remembering that, like, I did that quote about you, whether you're bragging about it or ashamed of it, you won't become enlightened without reading a Yak's load of books. So I looked that up. That's in volume one of the Great Treatise. And you know who said it? Atisha. Now, we don't know. It wasn't from his lips. It was like a hadith, as they say in, you know, it was a report from one of the Gadambas. Masters who said that Atisha said said this. Okay, now let's actually do some. So we've established that there are like these two designated great vehicle tenet systems and two fundamental vehicle or pinayana tenet systems. And on like page 38, 39 of the Appearance and Reality book, we kind of introduced the idea of like one of the things that's common that seems to me that's important and common between the middle way tenet systems and is not found in the other ones is this idea that the conventional and the ultimate are there are two aspects of the same thing, or there are two dimensions of the same entity, that the ultimate is, for the most part, and we'll see, like, there's like small exceptions to that, but generally the ultimate refers to an emptiness, if there's a lack of some kind of exaggerated existence, and the conventional refers to something upon which that exaggerated sort of existence has been superimposed. So you have this, you know, idea that the two, before in the other ones, it's like, well, these kinds of objects over here are the conventional ones, and these objects over here, which are different, are the ultimate ones. But then in the Mahayana systems, it's like pretty much wherever you turn, the two truths are like right together as like two aspects of the same thing. And we get stuck, attached to, reify the conventional aspect and never see the sort of channel B side, as I was saying before. That whole kind of model seems to work in slightly different ways, but generally, yeah, that applies to the Mahayana systems. They see the two truths as always right there together. And also, that this is possible. So this is possible because the ultimate is a lack or a negative quality, an absence, and it's an absence an attribute or a quality of each and every phenomenon that exists. So you have this idea that these absences or lacks exist, and that certain ones are extremely important and need to be realized because they're the opposite of this exaggerated kind of existence that we're superimposing upon things, and that these absences they're not different like entities from the conventional truths. So that seems like, it's obviously I can't have been the first person to think of that, but when I was writing this book, I thought, well, that seems to me like the way to make a difference between the Mahayana ones and the non-Mahayana ones. They have this idea of the two truths being together. We're very used to, obviously, the idea that a lack or an absence is something that exists. But, you know, I actually have to spend some time talking about this. I mean, people may have some qualms about saying, well, the ultimate reality is just a non-affirming negative, right? It's like sheer absence. It's like a nothing, you know? And it's like, when I teach, I find no matter how many times I say emptiness is not nothingness, then people will still write everything is nothing and on their papers. And then I'm like, well, not everyone will, but there's some people who that it just doesn't go in their mind very easily, right? That you, no, I just said that emptiness wasn't nothing. But to them, everything else that I said like that added up to the same thing. So it's like, well, you're saying that everything is nothing. So lacks or absences exist. This isn't just like some crazy prasangika idea. You know, realist philosophers, you know, who will also say that absences exist. So it's okay to talk about absences of specific things as different specific kinds of existence. It's not, I don't think, you know, a prasangika innovation to say that. So people have to first get used to that idea that there's different kinds of absences, which each can be the sheer absence of X and the sheer absence of Y. And those sheer absence of X is not coterminous in space and time with the sheer absence of Y, because there's some place where Y is and X isn't. And then those two absences aren't together. So you have to start by getting people used to the idea that absences are existing things. And then the issue becomes, well, once you understand, like, an absence, there's absence of the Potomac River, you know, in the Abbey, the absence of Saturn, you know, in the state of Washington, and so forth. And then you think, well, this is all quite ridiculous that there's an infinite number of absences, like, here right now, and why would we even be talking about that? Well, it's right. And the main reason is because, like, there's this one particular absence, one very specific absence, that in terms of just being a sheer absence is just like the others, but is the opposite of that which we've superimposed upon things, and having done that, that becomes the basis of our needless suffering and all the misery of the world. And so suddenly it's like, well, that particular absence is like worth talking about. It's like, you know, if everyone were having a massive hallucination about, you know, rampaging elephants, you know, in Spokane, then it wouldn't become ridiculous to talk about that not being the case. That the sheer lack of rampaging elephants in the streets of Spokane would suddenly become like a singled out among all of the sheer absences in the universe, of which there are infinite one number. It would become singled out as the uniquely important thing to talk about at that moment. Okay, so in that way, emptiness is like that. I'm not saying it's like in every single way exactly like that, but it is just like that. It's a sheer absence that's important because, you know, among all the different absences, because it's the opposite of the way people are thinking, because of, and on account of thinking that way, then they're suffering unnecessarily. So it's the relief to our delusion kind of sheer absence. Okay. So then another thing you could say, if you wanted to say, well, is that the only way it's different from other absences? The question is like, well, okay, even if everybody's hallucinating about rampaging elephants and it becomes very important to talk about that at that particular time, that's not the fundamental nature of Spokane, is its lack of rampaging elephants. It just... You see what I'm saying? It is... You follow? Oh, am I going to stumble into something? No. But you follow? That's not its fundamental nature. It is something that would be just as helpful, would be extremely helpful to people who had that superimposition. And just like, you know, in analogous to the way that if we think things are intrinsically existent, would be a helpful thing for us would be to hear that they're not. Right? But, and so in that way, of all the absences, there's certain some that are medicinal and some that aren't, depending on the sickness of the patient. You follow? But then among all the medicinal... Do you follow?
Well, I got the elephants in Spokane. Now the medicinal has got me lost.
The medicinal means like the ones that... The kinds of absences through hearing which were cured of our superimposition. So we have a superimposition. So medicinal is antidotal. You know, functioning as the antidote to our delusion. So the medicinal absences are the ones that fix whatever kind of sickness the deluded person has. So among all the medicinal absences, for all the different kinds of delusions from which living beings suffer, there's one particular medicinal absence that is particularly important, because it also, according to Buddhist tradition, is the fundamental nature of phenomena. That is, what would you mean? It's the way they exist. It is also an existent, right? But unlike other existents, it's the existent that describes how all existence, including itself, basically exists, right? So that makes that's its unique property, right? And because we have a misconception about that fundamental way that things exist, right? And suffer all suffering that samsara on that account, then it comes out that of all the medicinal absences that Buddha could talk about, like the lack of permanence in you know, persons and so forth, that the root cure for all of those, you know, delusions is pointing people at the absence of intrinsic nature at the root of things. Okay. I'm sorry if that was... Did I confuse people? Yes. No?
Up to the medicinal, you know, all that, I think,
yeah,
makes sense. But then we start talking about
how things exist.
To me, it's just as important that Saturn isn't in Washington State in order for Washington State to exist.
Mm.
You know, if it was, mm-hmm. then Washington State wouldn't really be able to exist.
Mm-hmm.
So I start to wonder. Mm. To me, it starts to reify things.
Mm-hmm. To say that there's a fundamental nature.
In a way, because then we say. The reason we call it the ultimate existence, or it's what's found by an Arya's meditative equipoise,
right.
emptiness. But what if an Arya was the meditative equipoise or something? It's just it seems to single it out in a way that makes it seem more real rather than more important, because it is more important than all the other ones. That makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
But to make it more.
You can't make it more real.
Yeah, that's
not. It's not. That's exactly what you can't. You have to have it as like each equally real in the sense that everything exists only conventionally. But then what this is it is exactly the way of talking about how everything exists only conventionally. It's the lack in things of existing in any way other than conventionally. See, what you're trying to say is like we don't want to reify it. Everything has to exist in the same level. Well, emptiness is just that. It's a way of talking about exactly that. Right? It's that quality in things of not having some, including itself, of not having some other non-conventionally imputed way of being. And so when you search to say what are things really, you know, you find this lack or absence. It's not like you find some affirmative graspable thing. You find something that is the utter lack of any graspable thing, and which appears to the mind in a non-deceptive way. That is, it presents itself as being just as empty as it is. That's the idea. Although later, you know, people could be attached to the idea of it. But the idea is that if you directly realize emptiness, to the mind at that time, it doesn't lie to you, and that other things to be careful, you know, it's like other things appear to our minds as though they had their own nature, and when we realize emptiness, that means that everything, including emptiness itself, lacks anything more than conventional existence, right? Then emptiness shows itself as being void, you know, that it's empty, it's empty of its own emptiness and so forth.
Wouldn't the lack, if we were to meditate on the lack of Saturn in Washington, also be empty of its own lack of Saturnness? I mean, if we were to apply that rationality, couldn't we do that with any negation?
When we meditate on the lack of Saturn in Washington, if we realize that,
yeah. I don't know what good it would do, but...
it's only because if you had a delusion. It's only if you had a delusion. You know, we could do the snake and the rope or the elephant and so it's like that. It's the same thing, right? It's people having some delusion. So, but if the idea is that just if you, these are different because there's What do you say? They're local and adventitious and derivative from something else, which is a misconception about the fundamental nature of how things themselves exist. Anyway, that's the idea. Jose Cabazon has made up a hypothetical universe, like the one where everybody's already enlightened. And he said, what if we had a universe that was just like this one, but in which everyone was born and karmically conditioned to have a more nihilistic view of things than what is true, rather than a reifying view? And then what would the right? And so then you say, well, I mean, my answer would be, well, the ultimate nature of things is still the same. And so even if you are innately falling to the opposite side, it still means that to be liberated, you have to realize the same thing, which is everything exists only conventionally. That is, everything's devoid, utterly devoid of anything other than this merely conventional existence. It would just be coming at it from the other side. Yeah.
Well, I think the way that you were talking, mentioning like absence of elephant wouldn't take care of Saturn.
It's correct. I did that. Right. Exactly. Right. But the idea was that ultimately all of our different kinds of exaggerated superimpositions are traced back in Buddhist way of understanding to this root delusion of exaggerating the basic status of how things exist. And if you sort of if you have a more accurate way of understanding things as they exist, then will help ramify upwards and clear up the different delusions that are springing from that, like the one about the person who cuts in front of me in line being the spawn of Satan by Voyager. By which I mean that they're naturally established as an object of my anger, a worthy recipient of my wrath. They have intrinsic smackability. calling out naturally from their own side. It's like we say, they're going to get what they have coming, right? And it's like, oh, they just naturally have, it's like, but I'm too good a person to find someone else. Someone else to give them with that which they so richly deserve. Right? And so that's what I mean by that's what we're talking about. It's like, well, if you have all the different afflictions, which is, what we're concerned that they have their roots in this. So that's what allows them to be inflamed and to bite into the mind and perpetuate themselves, is that they think that they're collaborating with this idea that there's some nature or ground, Okay, so that's introduction to Mayan systems. Now, the Chittamantra, page 42, and in Appearance and Reality, we quote from the Pali Canon, "The world is led by mind and drawn by mind. All phenomena are controlled by one phenomenon, mind." Very famous quote. The world is led by mind and drawn by mind. And this comes in the context about, people asking the Buddha, who created the world? Where did the world come from? And there's obviously people who feel strongly that there must be like a creator God. This very strong sense that, look, everything has to come from somewhere, but we can't just conceive of some infinite regress of things coming from other things, so there must be one thing that didn't come from anywhere, that just comes from itself, that is, I am,
is,
and then everything else can come to be because there's that doesn't depend on anything else. That's a very powerful idea. It's really powerful, something that just doesn't have to spread around from one culture to other culture. People start thinking about where stuff comes from and they arrive at this idea, right? So in ancient India, people, when they were asking these questions about where does it all come from, of course, this is one of the ideas they came up with. And Buddha was confronted with it. He said, well, it's not that there's some all-powerful Wongjuk, you know, is like Ishvara, who like makes everything. It's that the world is led by mind and drawn by mind, and all phenomena are controlled by mind. And then Chandrakirti, in along the same line, says Buddha teaches that all the complex worlds of living beings and all of their environments are established only by mind. And then to explain what that means, at this point in the text, he says, all transmigrating beings are born from actions. So therefore, you get the clear sense that for all Buddhists, whether you're Prasangika or mind only or anything, that the world is led by mind and controlled by mind, and it's mind that creates the world, means that our karma is what's creating appearances, and our karma, our actions, are creating appearances. Our choices are making the worlds of the future, creating the future. That is mean. Our karma means the intention, the quality of volition or intention or choice that precedes and accompanies an action. And so that's a factor of mind. It's not like the karma is the here in the subtle philosophical way. It doesn't ultimately refer mainly to the actual action, but it refers to the choice to act in such a way. But of course, then to be fully developed, you have to, you know, it's like people might have different intentions, and but it doesn't become sort of a full blown as a karma that can project a future life and then unless you follow through on your intentions. But still, the basic idea is that actions are not just when it says that the source of the world is the mind, Buddha is saying it's our choices, that our intentions, our volitions, that are creating the world in an ongoing way. And so that's the basic meaning that all Buddhists accept. And then, of course, there's this deeper idea that the world, as we see it, is being constructed in a manner that's like collaborative with ignorance, well, that is, with a deluded mind that sees things in an exaggerated and distorted way. But that meaning and how to interpret it is different among the different Buddhist groups. And the idea that thinking that all the worlds, you know, these things like thinking we were talking about mind vajra before, and it's like the mind, when you read this mind vajra, says all the phenomena of cyclic existence or nirvana are the sport of the mind vajra. Well, then you can turn around and say, well, let's go back. And the Buddha said all the phenomena in the world arise from and that are created by the mind. That is not meaning exactly the same thing, but that tradition of saying in some way we're going to interpret or explain the mind as the source of things, you know, runs through Buddhism from the most ancient sources down. So is it good for people who don't want to adopt an idealist worldview in which, you know, there are no external objects, to mess their minds around with, you know, philosophical systems that says that there's no external world? That is a matter of some disagreement in Madhyamaka tradition. The great Gelugpa scholar Guntang said it is appropriate for the discerning person who knows that just as Buddha taught, the basis for all happiness and all suffering is only his or her own mind, it's appropriate for that person to look at and rely upon the mind-only system. But there isn't complete unanimity about that, and the most famous dissenter, as like you've heard, is Bhava Viveka. Bhava Viveka says that for somebody who, you know, is following the middle way, the Madhyamaka view, to adopt and to take seriously to heart the mind-only tenets, and then after that, you know, see that as a stepping stone to later becoming a Madhyamaka. He said, this is just like first anointing oneself with mud and then later bathing. It would be better to keep one's distance from the beginning. So he didn't have a high regard he thought, well, this is really beyond the pale and not one of the right stepping stones. But Chandrakirti is of a different view, and he quotes to the sentence along Lanka Sutra, just as a physician gives medicines to a patient for illness, the Buddhas teach mind only to living beings. So it's, you know, this is medicinal according to Chandrakirti. mud, according to Balzaga. All right. Okay, so this is a basic idea of mind-only system is that in addition to that, there's no external world. Everything exists as one entity with mind. And so how can that be? Well, there's, instead of the usual six types of consciousness, you know, the five senses, the mental consciousness, then there's also two additional ones. And the eighth one is called Alaya. Somebody was asking me about that the other day. The Alaya Vijnana, which is Gunshi, the mind basis of all. And I think this is like, nowadays people are saying foundational consciousness. So that seems to be the, this is a good translation, foundational consciousness. Right. So some a foundational consciousness. It's not posited by other non-mind-only systems. Okay. But this wasn't like just some minor obscure thing. This was like a very, very, as Mahayana, you know, grew and became stronger in India, it was one, it was a widespread and important perspective, you know, with I think many people following this view, and also maybe many people following the Svatantrika view, and maybe not so many people following the Prasangika view, actually. Anyway, that seems to be the current thrust of Western scholarship about the history of Buddhist philosophy in India. So how is it that all things are, you know, of one entity with the mind? It's because we have, when we make, do an action, that leaves behind a trace, a latency, and that's conceived as a seed. And that trace, that latency, is stored in the mind basis of all. And some people used to call this the storehouse consciousness, because at least one of its functions was to be the repository, you know, of the what. All of our karma, you know, goes there, and then so the mind basis of all is the basis of all appearances, and then how is it that things appear? Well, you have different kinds of seeds, karmas from the past, and they ripen. That is, they come to fruition. And how is it that they come to fruition? Because they've been, out of all the different karmas that we've accumulated, some are ripened and caused to come to fruition because they've been perfumed, which means they've been influenced by the other kinds of consciousnesses that we're having. So you're having some kinds of experiences and interactions and consciousness, and these are like conditions which are causing some of the seeds in your alaya to pop open, and some of them to stay dormant at different times, right? So we could, like, we have all these anger seeds, and we haven't realized emptiness and burned them all up. So what's, you know, in the meantime, what do? We try to keep them dormant. It's like we don't have the fire of wisdom from Manjushri or from, you know, from our own wisdom to destroy them. So we have to just keep those seeds at bay until such time as we actually have the equipment to root them out, which is, you know, non-dual wisdom, realizing emptiness. So these seeds ripen, and as they ripen, you think of like pop open. You have those seeds that pop open, it's like that. It pops open like that. And when it pops open, it has two aspects. And it's one aspect is a subjective aspect, and the other is the objective aspect. And it's like, so it ripens in this form whereby it causes this dualistic appearance to arise. So it's like, there's not really like objects separate from my mind. You could think about it, it's like, well, somebody was saying the other day, well, everything's perception. You know, we have this feeling that it's like, well, we can't really get outside of the field of our experience. And mind only arises from that kind of understanding. It's like, well, everything's our experience. And so within our experience, there's this appearance of things is distant and cut off, like the mountains look really far away in Idaho, right? But actually, it's like, okay, so I have a seed that's like ripening, and it ripens in this subjective aspect side. As it pops open, there's a subjective side that's like my consciousness seeing the mountain, and then there's the objective side, which is the appearance of the mountain that my eyes seeing. And how do they get to, so since they're actually like one entity with the mind at that time, then how do they come to appear like so distant and cut off? Well, That's because of the seeds of past dualistic experience, and we have this like kind of, you know, root ignorance, which is in Chittamatra, which is the belief that things are different entities, that subjects and objects are different entities, and the lack of a difference of entity of subject and object is the emptiness that we have to realize in order to be free. But because we have all of our experience in the past have been conditioned by this, you know, false belief that objects and subjects were distant and cut off from each other, that they were separate entities, then, you know, one way to say it would be that, you know, the seeds are, I'm thinking of it sort of like the seeds are infused already with this dualistic aspect as they're planted, and so when they ripen, they still have it. But some people say, like, some people aren't happy with that, and so they want to say that there's like, every time a seed ripens, along with it, there ripens another seed, which puts a dualistic thing on top of it. I don't know. So, anyway, that's the idea. So, everything is, all these, say, karmas, latencies, predispositions, ripen one by one. But in fact, every consciousness is one substantial entity, and also you could say one entity with its object. They're inextricably linked. Each is indispensable to the other. But, you know, some people said mind only, Chittamatra, is misleading. Because it's not that there's mind only. There's mind and its objects. Mind is not objects. Mind and its objects are one entity. But it doesn't mean that, like, that mountain can look back at me. There are objects and there are consciousnesses, but they're like not ever separate. They're always one entity. So we also have a false appearance of things along with our idea that things are different entities from mind. They also look that way. I wanted to mention that because that comes back when we talk about Svatantrika next. I mean, they look like, some people, I've heard other people talk about this, you know, in a different kind of Buddhist tradition context, is saying, well, the basic problem is that it seems that I'm in here and you're out there. That there's this strong appearance, like, just as we sit here, that, like, things are they're just appearing as though they're cut off from us. It's like I tend to say, well, they don't disclose to us our interrelatedness, but of course then that's blaming the object side, which I've been caught on already. But I feel like it's like, well, they're tricking us. They're showing they're in disguise. They're presenting themselves. The mountain is like presenting this false aspect of being far away to me when really it's one entity with the mind perceiving the mountain. Right? So because things appear in a strongly vivid way as this, like, externally, then we assent to and are conditioned to and go along with this idea that, yeah, there's an external world that's distant and cut off from the mind. Okay, so this seems like, you could say, well, that, I don't really believe that. Like, why would people think that? Like, so they have reasons and arguments for thinking, you know, convincing themselves and others that there is no external world, that all phenomena are one entity with the mind apprehending them. And one of the arguments is to think about, they say, okay, well, you say that things really must be external, but think about how a dream is. If you have a dream, then in the dream, doesn't it seem like the objects that are appearing in the dream are far apart from you? You know, that you're not just like merging with them. They're over there and you're over here in the dream, and they then serve their functions in the dream, and that doesn't mean that they are really objective and apart from you. It just means that you're having a false appearance at the time. So they kind of like do a whole bunch of examples of how the world is like illusions and world is like dreams, to get people used to the idea that just because there's a strong, vivid appearance of something as being separate does not mean the thing is really apart from your mind. It can be like when you wake up from the dream, you realize that there was nothing apart from your own consciousness, even though in it, it very vividly appeared that there were separate objects. And say, like, in effect, it's like the, you know, how do you know that this isn't like that argument, right? Although they're not saying that this is a dream, but they're saying, how do you know that this isn't functioning in a way that's like how the dream is functioning? Okay, so that's one of their arguments. And then they have a lot of other, they have a lot of arguments to try to undermine people's sense. And another one that's very famous that we already did is the one about the gods, humans, and ghosts going to the river. And they're saying our solution to the problem of these, you know, different kinds of beings all going to the river and seeing different things is very simple. There's no external things. All of these, all of the nectar is appearing in but through the ripening of the god karma in the god mind, and the water is appearing through the ripening of the, you know, human karma in the human mind, and the pus and blood are appearing through the ripening of the preta karma in the preta mind, and it's just not any problem. There's not any like external world where you have to figure out how all these different contradictory substances are in the same place at the same time, because they're not. They're all one entity with the mind of the person, the mind of the living being who's apprehending them. That's what they say.
There's no matter. There's no none of these little particles.
No, everything is a one entity with the mind.
No matter. There's no matter at all.
I don't think so. Everything is, I've never heard people talk about matter.
They refute the partless particles, so they refute an external world composed of partless particles. Mm-hmm. But they don't really address the issue, is there an external world with non-partless particles?
Yeah. Okay.
But there isn't any world that's a different entity from our mind.
Yeah.
So if there were some matter, it would have to be of one entity with a consciousness.
Yeah. It's just an appearance.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, those are some of the reasoning arguments, and then they also have a bunch of sutra quotes that they use to point, which, you know, from the usually the third turning of the wheel, seeming to suggest this. One is the Avatamsaka Sutra, saying that the three realms are merely mind, quote unquote, famous one, and then other one is the Descent into Lanka Sutra. External appearances do not exist. And the Sutra on the Ten Grounds said the three realms are mind only. So these kinds of sutra quotes, together with this sort of suspicion about how you can have different kinds of beings seeing different kinds of things, and also then the problem of like how you establish external appearances, then lead people into thinking, well, this would be a way, I think, to establish why it is we suffer unnecessarily, is because we're projecting this objective reality, by which we mean here some external to our mind kind of reality, onto things that it doesn't really have. There's all kinds of problems with the mind-only system, which I've thought about it, and I do like go through in some of these books, like, how do they answer this one? How do they answer this one? And I, when I was doing this, I took these different questions, and I would try to go back to the text, including some of our, you know, original texts, and see. And, you know, it really, it's not that they didn't think of these things. I mean, some of them are argued about, like, some things you could say, like, well, why are we all seeing ourselves as here together? And are you all in my mind? And these kinds of things they talk about. So the idea is that there are different living beings, right? God, the Father, the Ghost, and Christ. The different living beings, and we're here in this room together. In what that means is that each of us, each of our minds has some very, very similar karma. It's not quite exactly the same, right? But it has this big overlap, such that like your karma, like now, is creating this a certain thing that I don't see, which is how I look with the altar behind me, and my, right, and mine's creating a different thing where I'm seeing you down there with that like heater or something behind you. But it's not exactly the same, but it's like there's common karma, that common karma that we, the people in this room at this time, share, is what causes us to all be able to, you know, say, oh, there's the lineage tanka or something like that, and that we're here in this room together because we have this shared karma. And so it's ripening together. It's not exactly the same, but it's so similar. That's what causes the experience for living beings, you know, being able to talk about common objects. It's not actually exactly the same object. It's like a dream we're having together, a big overlapping dream that we're having together. It's a communal dream. I think that's right. They don't actually say that, but that's the way I understand it. Yeah. And then, you know, and they would say, well, you know, sometimes even people who are together see things slightly differently, you know, and that's because it's not anything there externally. It shows that it's really something that's arising as one entity with their minds, which are distinct entities from each other. My mind and your mind are different entities. Objects appearing to my mind are one entity with my mind. Objects appearing to your mind are one entity with your mind. Okay? So, skipping over some of the other qualms that we could raise about this system, I would say, I might be speaking about myself, maybe, I don't know, I say some of us may have a tendency to want to jump over the mind-only system, or maybe some of the ones before it, and say, since I like the middle way school, and the middle way school affirms an external world, and then why should I, you know, I'm just going to, I like it that way. I like believing in an external world, and the highest system says that there's an external world, so... I agree there's an external world. Then I don't want to mess with a system that's telling me there's no external world. It's just going to cause me a problem when really, you know, it's going to turn out when I get to the higher view it exists anyway. I guess we can't help but think that. So here's what you have to think. It's like, okay, there are no inherently existent external objects. The reason, like, the mind-only system, they believe that there are inherently existent objects. They believe these inherently existent objects are like one entity with the mind, but they believe in inherent existence. Yeah. Right. So they believe in inherent existence. So when we say, oh, yeah, I'm not going to bother with that. You know, it's like because they're refuting is that what we're really doing is we're sort of confirming or holding on to our belief in inherently existent external objects. And, you know, this is the why Chandrakirti would say something about, like, the mind-only view. It's true. In the end, Chandrakirti is going to say there are external objects. But the sense in which he's going to assert them is so different from our ordinary way. And the medicine of the mind-only way loosens up our attachment to the idea. It marinates us in the idea that there isn't something that exists independently of the mind that has something out there on its own side objectively. And so it's like, oh, even this lower system, you know, doesn't hold on to that, is able to get used to the idea that there's no object that's just existing out there independently of my mind. You're going to have to deal with that in a slightly different form, right, when you get to the Sangha. There is an external world, but they're still going to have the gods, ghosts, and humans going to the river and seeing different things and saying that they're all right. And now you've got all the different stuff is out there in the river. So, you know, it's like, this is the idea, is that this can be something that's helpful in losing our attachment to the external world. Okay, so let's see how I do. Okay, so they teach... you guys know that Chittamatra is often, you know, also called Yogacara, and has this historical connection to yogic practice. We don't know very much. I don't know very much to say about that, but certainly that is one of the ideas about. It relates to what I was saying earlier that, you know, the genesis for this could be yogic experience, right?
Do you know why this tradition more than, let's say, the Vanyatmaka as an affiliation with yogic practice? If eventually all these highly realized beings
are you doing yogic practice?
Are becoming Vanyatmaka?
Well, I can say something, but I can't say, you know, that this is like, okay. This is my understanding, is that when you do, Shine, you know, you're doing concentration meditation. So you're cultivating the fifth perfection, you know, concentrating your mind, suppose you stabilize your mind one pointedly on a single object, then, you know, even though you're not having any non-dualistic realization of something profound, people notice that. They talk about, like, you know, absorption. You have the word absorption, and then also they use the word penetration. So that there's like something there's like a collapse of kind of a dualistic aspect between the mind, as ordinarily appears, between the mind and the object you're meditating on when you have, you know, deep concentration. Well, that's pretty much all there is to my idea, is that, like, that because this, that people are doing, that there's, if people are doing a lot of this kind of meditation, then they find that their experience, their deeper experiences that they think, you know, they're taking as their more profound experiences are not confirming, but are rather disconfirmatory of the ordinary sense that, like, objects are out there apart from us. And so then they have to say, well, how do we account for this? You know, all the Satchanikas are saying like this, and Vaibhashikas are saying like that. But, you know, it seems to us that, like, when we meditate deeply, that this appearance of objects apart from the mind is false. Yeah, that's all. That's there may be more to it, but that's all I know. So anyway, then they have this system. They do have the two truths in mind only, but they mainly talk about the three natures. And so I tried to work out on page 49 of Appearance and Reality a way to think about, you know, how the three natures maps to the two truths. Basically, they like to say things like this: the dependent nature, free of the imputational nature, is the thoroughly established nature. That's what they say. So, like, dependent nature means all of, like, the ordinary things we see that, like, are dependent arisings that interact. The imputational nature, although it has a couple of different levels of meaning, the main, you know, the one that's important for us is this non-existent imputational nature, that is this false overlay. So you have a cup, you have the false attribution to the cup, imputed to the cup, as being distant and cut off, you know, or being a different entity from my mind. And then you have the cup's thoroughly established nature, which is its utter lack of any separateness from the entity of the mind that's apprehending it. Okay. If, by the way, it isn't the mind apprehending it, because then it would be apprehending itself, right? And it would have, you know, it would be clear in knowing and so forth. So the cup is not the mind, but it's one entity with the mind that's apprehending it. So some people, you know, there's this other name besides Yogacara and Chittamatra. There's this third name, Vijñaptimatra. And people have translated this as, like, representation only and so forth. And they've said that's not such a common name that I've heard in Tibetan studies, but it's become more popular recently in the West. And it's sort of going against people thinking that mind only says that only mind exists. It doesn't say that only mind exists. It's there are objects that are not mind, right? There's form, and there's compositional factors, and there's consciousnesses. But the forms are one entity with the mind, and so are the compositional factors, so one entity with the mind. And the compositional factors, by the way, include that's what the karma is. So karma is the compositional factors that go in that category. Anyway, so it's not very hard to figure. There's so much that's written about that, these three natures. But basically, for our purposes, you can say the ultimate truth corresponds to the thoroughly established nature and refers most importantly to the utter lack or the emptiness of there being any difference of entity between the subject and object. And conventional truth mainly refers to the other powered natures or dependent natures, the things that possess the quality of lacking difference of entity. So the people, the tables, the cups and chairs and the mountains and so forth are the kind of nature. And then imputational nature is just what the stuff that we're falsely projecting or overlaying on top of that. So conventional truths are roughly equivalent to the dependent nature. Ultimate truths are roughly equivalent to the thoroughly established nature. Okay. Just to make it complicated, there are a few types of imputational natures which are also conventional truths, and those turn out to be kind of like what we call conventional truths in the Satchanika system. It's all these, like, permanent phenomena or abstractions or, you know, mental objects, right? That are not, you know, in the Satchanika system, we have ultimate truths, or these real things that are changing and disintegrating moment by moment, right? So those ultimate truths from Satchanika, now they're called the conventional truths or dependent natures, right? they're not ultimate truths anymore. They went back to being the way they should have been in the first place, right? And then, the idea is that we have ideas or images or what do you say? It's like generic images, conceptual representations that stand for those things in a dualistic conceptual mind that don't change moment by moment, right? And those are called they're called existent imputational natures. So like unlike all the other imputational natures, those are cases of imputational things that actually exist. Okay, so there is, you know, as I was like studying this again, it struck me after just having studied Sautrantika, I was really struck by how similar Sautrantika and Chittamatra are in a lot of their ideas about how the mind works. It's almost like in some ways they've taken the Sautrantika system and they've then added on to the idea that there isn't any external world. But they have like the same idea about, you know, conceptual thought and direct perception and objects of conceptual thought being permanent and not changing moment by moment. Those, that kind of epistemology, way of the mind works and what kinds of object the mind works, it's really imported right into the, it's in the Chittamatra system. You know, it's slightly different use of the words. Okay.
Chittamatra say a lack of a self-sufficient, substantially existent person is a
yes.
Thoroughly...
Is it a thoroughly established nature? Yes, on page 50, I say thoroughly established natures are both selflessnesses. I was about to mention this. There are two self. Well, actually, there are three selflessnesses. Yeah, but to start with, we'll say that there's two selflessness: selflessness of phenomena and selflessness of persons. Okay, there's two selflessnesses in that sense, just like there is in Madhyamaka. Okay, so. The selflessness of persons and selflessness of phenomena are both ultimate truths. And so they're both thoroughly established natures. But one is coarser than the other. The selflessness of persons is a person's emptiness of being a substantially existent self. Meaning this is not a self-sufficient... a person is not a self-sufficient being that's able to set itself up as the controller of the aggregates. They're saying, well, you have to realize that. And, you know, that's like the coarser emptiness, all right? You have to realize that. But when they say that the person is not like self-sufficient, substantially existent, what they mean is as I said, is that there's no like person that just exists independently on its own. They don't mean that when you go and look among the aggregates, you won't find anything that you can say that's the person, because there is, and that turns out to be the foundation consciousness, the alaya. So the alaya is the person in a sense. It's what goes from life to life. It's what carries our karma from life to life. You can say that it is the person. What you can't do is say that it's the substantially existent self-sufficient person, because it's not. It's dependent upon the other consciousnesses, and it's dependent upon the physical aggregates as well to function as a person. It's not just a person, a self-instituting person, but nonetheless you can't say that it is the person. That's a very interesting thing that, like, we did talk about this very briefly before, that it's like all the other tenet systems, when they say that things are imputedly existent, like in this case, and that they don't have their own self-sufficient nature, they still all think that when you go and look on the side of the basis of imputation, there's something that you will be able to find and get hold of that really is the thing. And that's because that's what it means to believe in inherent existence, that there's something out there among the basis of designation that is the thing that you're looking for. And they still think that, you know, we're still solving the problem. I mean, from the point of view of these other systems, they're following a middle way. They don't say, oh, you know, we're going to the left and those middle way people are going to the middle. No, they think they're following a middle way. And they're following a middle way because they're saying, we avoid the extreme of nihilism because we say that there is a person. And here we can show you what it is. It's this alaya. And we're avoiding the extreme of, you know, reification, because we understand that this person is not self-sufficient, but is like contingently existing in relationship to the other aggregates. And So that's a selflessness that you have to realize. Then there's this subtler, deeper selflessness that's harder to realize, that you have to realize in order to become a Buddha. And that's the selflessness of the phenomena. By the way, I just forgot to mention. So the selfness of persons is what the Chittamatra people say that the Hinayanists realize on their path. And then they're saying, well, if you really become a Buddha, you can't just limit yourself to realizing that the person is empty of self-sufficient status. You also have to realize the emptiness of things being a different entity from the mind. So, then just to make it extra complicated, they say that there's two kinds of selflessness of phenomena, one which add up to the same thing, but one of which is supposedly easier to realize than the other. So we should think about that one, because that will give us a head start on the harder to realize one. And so the one that's harder to realize is the one that I've already been talking about, is that things are empty of being a different entity from the mind that's apprehending. The one that's supposed to be easier, that says to be just as subtle as, but easier to realize than the non-existence of subject and object of different entities, is the non-existence of things as a natural referent of the term that's designating them. Things lack a character so as to be the natural reference of the term that's designating them. Well, so that what that means is the... remember, this is all in the think of it in relationship to what we were doing with Sautrantika before, that an object has a consciousness, has the object itself, which you're thinking of, and then this internal generic image representation that, you know, you're using to stand for what you're thinking of, okay? All right, and of course, you know, when we're doing conceptual thought, that's what conceptual thought means, is that we're thinking about X by way of an image in our mind of X. Okay, so what they're going to say is that there isn't any this secondary reference. So when I have this thought of car, the primary referent of the car, the primary referent of the thought car, is this mental image in my mind of the car. And the secondary referent is the actual car out there. That's what they say. Okay? So far? So, then they say, there isn't any character in the car, the secondary reference, so as to be the natural basis of the mind car, the same car. It doesn't have anything established on its own side, in its own character, so as to be like the natural, to be established as the referent of that name. So this is like, I find that this is like hard to think about, but I was like, I had this experience the other day that was sort of like this, I think. So we were walking up to the temple and I said, what's that in regard to an object? And then, you know, the answer was, that's a birdhouse, right? But it didn't look like a birdhouse to me, but then, like, so it didn't easily fit into that schema. But so the idea was that I felt strongly that there was something that was out there. Even before I had the name, I already felt that there was something on the object side, external from my mind, that made it the natural reference for a term, which I had yet to locate. But you see, when we call things, we feel that it's very natural for them to be a suitable basis of that term. And it's like, oh, well, it's, you know, they could be the basis. I'm not attached to English, but they're going to be the natural reference of the basis of different terms of different language. But in any way, either way, you know, they can have, it's like how many languages as they are, they have the character of being the natural basis, the natural reference for the terms that we use to think about them and refer to them. Right? And even before I know the term for something, even when I don't have a name for it, I already feel that there's something on its side that makes it the natural reference for some word which I've yet to locate. Okay? So that's the idea. And it's like, if you think about that, then that's supposed to help you understand. It's supposed to be like, if you can understand that, then you'll understand this same idea that objects lack any difference of entity between the mind and the object of the mind. Because it adds up to the same thing. That's the idea, that there's nothing out there apart from my mind that has some character of, on its own accord, deserving to be called by this or that particular name. I know that's a little bit difficult, but that's the teaching about the selflessness in Chittamantra. It's like I'm not very far from end, so just like they have then definitions of the two truths in Chittamantra are made up, I would say, probably by Gelugpas who are, you know, studying the system and saying this is how we'll teach the two truths, because the two truths, as I said, was they did mention the two truths, but it wasn't like a huge object of discussion in their texts. They were talking about the three natures and no external world and the alaya, and they weren't saying a big section on the two truths with definitions in there. So people have to like look and say, if they do believe in the two truths and talk about the two truths, what does it seem to come out to? And Gernsha Chikmin Wangbo, you know, a Gelugpa author, says, in Chittamantra, an ultimate truth is an object found by a correct knower that distinguishes an ultimate object, and a conventional truth is an object found by a correct knower, which is a valid cognizer distinguishing a conventionality. And it's like, well, that's the kind of definitions that you often get in these textbooks. So it's like, seem to tell you nothing. But then you do have to think about it. It's like, okay, what have they packed in there? The idea that there's a conventional and there's an ultimate, and each of them is known by a correct knower. So you can just like you can see that this is like a Gelugpa textbook retelling of Chittamantra, where the real point is to get across the idea that there's a valid kind of knowledge with regard to each of the two truths. And really, if you just read that, there's nothing particularly Chittamantra about it. So there are other Gelugpas who have different ways of defining the two truths in Chittamantra, which are also made up, but they're attempting to be a little bit more particular to the Chittamantra system, is saying, well, an ultimate truth is something which, when you realize it, helps you overcome obstacles on the path to liberation in Chittamantra, or something like that, and so forth. And a conventional truth is the opposite of that. That is something which, when you realize it, doesn't help you overcome those obstacles.
So the Chittamantras in India didn't develop these kinds of definitions of things?
No, they didn't. I've never seen any Indian definitions of the two truths in Chittamantra, and I think, nor have I seen the Tibetans, when they're talking about the definition of two truths in Chittamantra, cite, you know, any Indian source backing up exactly why. And also, you see the fact that there's such different definitions within Gelugpa. I think it means that you have a very, very full presentation of the teaching, and you do have some reference to the two truths, but it's such a minor, it's not one of their categories, right? When they talk about what were the kinds of things that exist and how they relate to each other, they talk about the three natures. And they go on and on about them a lot more than I did, you know. Very detailed explanations. So, yeah, they like to say things like, the ultimate, the thoroughly established nature is the dependent nature without, minus the imputational nature, and then get you to think about what that means. And then they like to say that all three natures exist with regard to each phenomenon, but you just have to know how to posit them and so forth. And so that's the kind of presentations that they do instead of talking about the two truths. So let's say I just end this. So proponents of the Prasangika system, as I mentioned, do not regard the refutation of external objects that's presented in Chittamantra as literally acceptable. They argue that consciousnesses and external objects are interdependent. Neither exists without the other. Thus, if there were no external objects, then there wouldn't be any consciousnesses, because these two are co-established, interdependent in a sense. They each require the other. In Prasangika, the externality of objects is a legitimate conventional understanding of the world. But like everything else that exists at all, external objects exist in conventional terms. So that's not, you know, that's like a problem that Prasangika has with Chittamantra, definitely. But at the same time, you know, there's the other problem is that When you say that things look, here's, suppose that your assertion is that there's an emptiness you have to realize is an utter lack of difference of entity between subject and object. Why do you keep insisting, why do you, Chittamatra, keep insisting on calling that no external objects? Why don't you call that no internal objects? There's no, the core idea is that there's no difference of entity between subject and object, then why do you privilege the subject side? It's because subtly you, Chittamatras, have like an attachment to this alaya as like something that is, you know, not just the foundation of the universe, but is like inherently existent. And of course they do have exactly that, right, idea. And so there's like a sense that the denial of external objects is going hand in hand with a kind of over reification that's going on of everything that's on the subjective side. And just like, you know, when we went from Vaibhashika to Satranika, I was trying to suggest that, you know, by moving away from the emphasis on parts and wholes and shifting it to conceptions versus perceptions, that there's a kind of like saying, hey, we're not going to find what's really real by just looking at smaller and smaller bits. We're kind of trying to equalize to some extent the reality status of parts and wholes. Then in this way, you know, what Madhyamaka is doing is saying, well, Chittamatra has tipped the balance. The subject and object are interdependent, but they're making it like that, and we agree with that, but they're making it like that's just another way of saying everything's one with mind. Why don't you say, like, you could go the other way and say, like, if everything's one nature, and you say, why not say everything's one with matter? You know, well, they didn't do that. And why wouldn't they do that? It's because, I think it's because consciousness is self-evident. That's the way people say it. It's like, well, you know, we're having this all the time, whereas that's out there and it's harder to, you know, be sure about because it's all appearing in our consciousness. But, and so that, I think that's the experiential answer to that. But philosophically, from the Prasangika point of view, it's like, well, these two things are interdependent, but you've privileged one and over the other. So we have to try to balance that out. So if we take the attitude, well, we're not going to bother with Chittamatra because we're going to come back and affirm external objects anyway in Prasangika, then we end up affirming in our minds external objects from within our ordinary sense of how things exist. And we don't actually surpass the mind-only view, but we fall short of it. That's what I have to say. Questions? Yes?
How does direct perception work? The mind object?
Well, if you have an object that's suitable to be an object of direct perception, you know, then, you know, you have a seed that ripens in the aspect of an eye consciousness that is, you know, apprehending a patch of blue, right?
And,
yeah, it's the same thing. It's like there are ideas about this. As I said, it's like this. It's Sautrantika imported into one entity with the consciousness, and then put in, you know, the idea about talking about things in terms of three natures instead of the two truths. But the epistemology seems like Sautrantika to me. These ideas were developing around the same time. Yes?
So what I'm proposing is to generalize into aggregates, which then creates the external here.
Yeah. Exactly.
So that seems very much like what Prasangika is saying, just in the reverse way.
How so?
That objects are dependent on the mind is dependent on the aggregates.
Oh, I see. Because you're saying, like, oh, the storehouse consciousness depends on the aggregates, and then having it dependent on the aggregates, it creates the world, right? Well, of course, you have to remember that the aggregates are also one entity with the mind. They can't, there's nothing like, there aren't any external objects. It's like, there aren't any objects that are not one entity with the mind apprehending them.
But you did say that there's eight consciousnesses?
Or eight. I never mentioned the number seven one. I just left that out. Did you want that?
That refers to somehow the different numbers still have, because otherwise it would be just one consciousness.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, they're one entity and everything is one entity with the mind. So as the seeds are stored in the storehouse consciousness, And then as they ripen all still as one entity with the mind, but they ripen an aspect of this is, you know, a direct perceiving eye consciousness on this side, and this is a you know, a patch of blue over on this side. So all of these different experience object entities are arising out of the alaya, which is, you know, one of the eight consciousnesses, and they have to arise in the aspect of the different, including in the aspect of these different consciousnesses. That's the only way I can understand it. And one of the consciousnesses, I didn't ever explain the seventh one. The seventh one is the one that, like Klishta Manas, afflicted mind, it just constantly observes. It has a single object of observation in an ongoing way, and it observes the alaya, observes the foundation consciousness, and mistakenly regards it as a self-sufficient, you know, substantially existent self. That's its job, is to be dumb. Dumb and problematic. Yeah.
Why? Well, I mean, to the point to get rid of that consciousness? That sounds a little strange.
Yeah, well, I don't know what happens to that consciousness when you become a Buddha, but that it's true. It's an afflicted mind, so it's like, okay, well, what would be the idea? It's like, as we're going along, the world is like always having these false appearances, and what's giving rise to the moment? It's like, okay, here's the problem that's come up in you. I don't go around thinking every minute of every day having a thought of this book inherently exists, right? But so at what point in my day does the root of cyclic existence consciousness arise? Is there a certain, you know, moment you can point out? Like, so then when people want to meditate on emptiness, they have to say, oh, where is that consciousness that's the root of cyclic existence? As I'm alleged to be you know, holding that things are have some inherent nature of their own, but where is that mind? That I have to refute it, I have therefore to identify it, I have to see what it's like. And so then you have to go to some trouble, as I was, like, you know, talking about, to find, not just to have a conceptual idea about properly what the object of negation is philosophically, but experientially, what it feels like introspectively to catch yourself in the act of having the kind of mind that's the root of cyclic existence. It's not that obvious. It's not obvious. And so then you have meditation instructions about, like, okay, well, you can try this and you try that, and that will start to get you an idea of what it feels like, you know, when you're going, ah! You know, and so, you know. And so I see this as like the answer to that kind of problem, because we're going to have a persistent idiot mind that's going to be doing the work of reifying things on an ongoing basis as they appear. So, like, things are constantly popping into existence. Like, here's a weird thing. I glossed over this, but the weird thing is, like, in other systems, since there's an external world, and you have a cup, you know, have a cup, what do you say? I have a perception of the cup. It arises in dependence upon, you know, the cup and my, you know, sense faculty, and then my consciousness, and then perception of the cup arises in dependence on those causes and conditions, right? Well, the cup that is, like, since it's a cause of my, one of the causes, the cup that is, like, giving, is serving as a cause, is actually, like, there an instant before my consciousness of the cup, right? Because the cause is before the effect. But it's not like that in mind only, because they don't have any external world. The objects of perception and the perceptions of the objects are simultaneous. And so that being the case, like, when is there time for a reifying mind to get in? You see what I'm saying? And so it has to be, like, going on all the time. That doesn't my understanding.
Geshe Dorje Gyamdo explained that piece as how our appearance comes in here simultaneously. Not using the mirror thing for anything else, but in explaining that, like, how is it happening? He said, you know, right like that. You're in the mirror. You're in front of the mirror. That's how it comes.
Right.
So that was somewhat helpful to get that for me, kind of get that.
How it arises simultaneously.
Yeah, there's not a moment where it's, if you stand in front of, as soon as you're there, it's
right.
Simultaneous.
Right.
But then it's very hard to say that the object causes, that you even need sense organs at all. why do you use sense organs? It's the object of consciousness of nature and
Yeah.
All you need is karma, but then, yeah. It's like the, you know, the you know, but just to tie this back to the yesterday's discussion, you know, when you think about like this idea that that all the world is sort of the sport of some fundamental mind in the Nyingma system, and that then, you know, Shindong has like the similar kind of idea that there's this way in which this philosophy has been mixed together with Madhyamaka and then with Kalachakra and other tantric teachings. And then that's where you get this idea that like things are just, there's some very deep fundamental kind of consciousness. Here we're calling it like alaya or foundational consciousness, or you call it, you know, mind vajra for Nyingma. And then the world is like the good things and bad things. Everything is just all of our consciousnesses, all of the apparently separate objects of consciousness are all just running up and dancing around like it's coming out of a movie projector or something like that. A movie projector is this, you know, some fundamental mind that's shooting up these images, you know, and it's like we're thinking, we're looking at this and going, oh man, this stuff is so cool, and we're not realizing that it's all being projected from this fundamental basis. And I think those ideas are very, very similar. It's like it's not. They don't have to cite, you know, the sutras in those texts to, in order. They can sometimes just cite tantric texts, but sometimes they do cite them. I mean, these ideas go together. Yeah.
To use the dream analogy, when one wakes up, how would they then interact to help other sentient beings? Because the only way we're able to interact before is by the shared karma.
Mm-hmm.
How does that work in terms of
your ideas of, yeah, it's very profound, you know, kind of purification of the stream of consciousness. And I think, you know, it's like the understanding is you have this foundational consciousness becomes purified, and this becomes like the sort of truth body, basis of enlightened mind. And it obviously would seem to allow you to cause, you know, emanation bodies to appear in everybody's dreams. Everybody's, not dreams, but dream-like appearances in our worlds, can appear in our worlds, our interactive worlds. You know, that idea that the awakened one appears in our dream-like world in order to awaken us from the dream-like condition in which we're existing is not uniquely Chittamatra, right? That's like, you can find that in Theravada. They say the same thing, like you're using dream-like appearances or emanations to enter our dream-like projections and try to wake us up. No? They don't say that?
No, because Buddha was an ordinary being when he appeared on Earth.
Oh, no. I see what you're saying. Yeah, Buddha was an ordinary being, but he was an awakened being who recognized the way things were appearing to the beings around him as being false and delusory. So, oh, I see what you're saying. So, like, Buddha's just still a guy who's walking around. He's not, like, magically entering into their dreams.
Right.
Well, I was thinking of a passage, a quote from Bhikkhu Ananda Maitreya, where he says, you know, the teachings of Buddha is like using a dream to master another dream. So that reminds me of this idea, you know, that Buddha getting up and going out to teach, even in a Theravada way, doesn't apprehend his activities of going and teaching as substantial in the same way, but rather as having a dream-like character. But he participates in this dream-like activity in order to, like, awaken other people. That's what I meant. Yeah, not that they have a Buddha who has a the same kind of bodies that we have in Mahayana, with magical things like that. Yeah, super normal place. Okay, thank you. Let's do Svatantrika then later.